The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Rachman Review. I'm Gideon Rachman, Chief Foreign Affairs Commentator of the Financial Times. As the pandemic eases, I finally got back on the road. So this week's edition comes from Washington, D.C. My guest is Jacob Halbrun, who's editor of the National Interest magazine and an expert on U.S. foreign policy and on American conservatism. Our topic's the future of democracy in the United States and its implications for the wider world. Has the Biden administration stabilized the American system? Or is this just a pause before the next crisis? Ever since he came to office, Joe Biden's made it clear that he believes he's involved in a battle to save American democracy. Here he is at his inaugural address, which was made just 2 weeks after pro-Trump demonstrators had stormed the U.S. Capitol.
This is Democracy's Day, a day of history and hope, of renewal and resolve. Through a crucible for the ages, America has been tested anew, and America has risen to the challenge. Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause, the cause of democracy.
The Democrats had hoped that the storming of the Capitol would lead Republicans to repudiate Donald Trump. But the opposite has happened. Trump's still the dominant figure in the party. He's back on the road and already hinting heavily that he intends to run again for the presidency.
Back in the state where presidential campaigns are born, former President Trump rallying supporters and hinting at a 2024 bid.
Back to make America great again. Dash, slash, comma, again. Make America great again, I don't know.
The fear among some commentators is that the Trump revival means that America's heading for a new crisis. The root cause would be Republican efforts to rig the electoral system at state level to prevent Democrats from winning. This thesis was set out in a recent article by the influential commentator Robert Kagan, which was called "Our Constitutional Crisis is Already Here." Kagan warned of the threat of mass violence, a breakdown of federal authority, and the division of the country into warring red and blue enclaves. And America's already had a small taste of that in previous clashes between pro- and anti-Trump demonstrators.
Many of the protesters covered their faces, dressed all in black. A mesh barrier meant to separate the two sides quickly fell down. Protesters began pushing, shoving, and hitting people on the opposite side.
Robert Kagan's warning captured many of the darkest fears of political Washington. So when I sat down with Jacob Halbrun in the boardroom of the National Interest, I started by asking him what he thought of the Kagan thesis.
Kagan's essay focused on the idea that we are at bottom Weimar Germany. It used to be said that Bonn is not Weimar during the Cold War. Now everyone's wondering, is Washington Weimar? Are we about to slide into extra-parliamentary opposition? Do we have a Republican Party inside the U.S. Capitol that is fundamentally hostile to democracy and looking to hijack the American political process? And are the Democrats replicas of the liberals and socialists in the Weimar Republic who capitulated to the Nazis? By the final third of the essay, Bob Kagan invokes Nazi Germany, the Catholic Center Party, the German elites who failed to recognize the danger that Hitler represented. And Hitler was installed in power, of course, by a conservative cabal. He didn't actually win the election when he became chancellor on January 30th, 1933. So this is the nightmare scenario for the United States. I do not believe that we are in that kind of crisis right now.
So let's take the Republican Party first, because you said that one of the open questions is this still a party committed to democracy? And given the number of people in the party, the mainstream now, certainly in Congress, seem to be at least willing to give house room to the Trumpian theory that the election was stolen. So is it still a party that's committed to democracy?
There's no question that you've had serious erosion in the Republican Party. The presence of Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert.
These are congresswomen, yeah.
Yes, these are radical right figures. You know, there is a division between the right and the radical right, between genuine conservatives and then those who traffic in conspiracy theories, including anti-Semitism, which Marjorie Taylor Greene clearly does. Then you have someone like the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy from California, who initially distanced himself from Trump after January 6th and now has come around again. So what we see in the Republican Party, perhaps it might be more precise to say, I'm not sure someone like Kevin McCarthy or Mitch McConnell is anti-democracy. I think what they want to do, obviously, and this is where Kagan's analogy comes into play, is they want to harness the energies that these radical wings represent and use them for their own ends. The question is, will they in fact be engulfed by the very forces that they're trying to manipulate? That is precisely what happened at the end of Weimar Germany.
Yeah. But I suppose you could say that on January the 6th, the Republican Party and the events surrounding it just about came through, in the sense that Senator McConnell didn't throw his weight behind the effort to overturn the election. Mike Pence validated the results. And maybe even more important, state officials in places like Georgia didn't allow the election to be subverted. But again, one of the scenarios that people are concerned about is that in the intervening months and in the run-up to the next midterms and presidential election, the Republican Party is changing, and that those sort of principled officials may not be around to perform that task again. Is that a danger?
It's certainly a danger. Is it an acute one? We don't know yet, because these elections haven't been run. We don't know what the voter turnout will be. Some of Trump's tactics backfire. For example, when he tells the voters that the elections are rigged, it looks like in the Georgia Senate election that took place, where Raphael Warnock won the Senate seat, that Trump inadvertently suppressed Republican turnout by saying that these elections were rigged from the outset. And in the California election, where a lot of people worried that Gavin Newsom would not be able to survive the recall effort, he won handily. We have another state race coming up in Virginia, where Terry McAuliffe is running against the Republican candidate, Glenn Youngkin. Again, if McAuliffe wins by a comfortable margin in Virginia, it suggests that the Trump tactics are not that successful politically. This is the key. Is Trumpism really a potent threat, or does it maneuver the Republican Party into a blind alley? Are they then trapped with him? The Republican Party has not resolved this dilemma. Right now, it's swung toward the Trump side, but it's not necessarily going to be successful. That is why I refuse personally to succumb to the alarmism that suffuses much of the American elite. The fact is, we do have a Democratic Senate, House of Representatives, and Joe Biden can still prove to be a very effective president.
We'll come back to the Democrats in a moment, but just on the Republicans, I mean, Trump obviously, well, it seems obvious to me, is primarily motivated by his own interests. But is there such a thing as Trumpism? I mean, you've written a lot about the sort of currents of thought in the conservative movement, neoconservatives, etc. Do you now see a coherent body of ideas behind Trump?
There's definitely a wing of Republican governors, senators, who are trying to capitalize on what Trump was the first to stoke from a brush fire into perhaps an inferno in the American political system. Let's face it, Donald Trump was not popular among the regnant Republican elites when he initially ran during the primaries. It was treated as a catastrophe for the Republican Party. Now you have Josh Hawley, even Marco Rubio, Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, who are all trying to be mini-me's of Trump. So it is definitely a path that the Republican Party, a good chunk of it, is following. But we simply don't know yet whether that's actually a viable path.
And what are the ideas? I mean, Hawley said, didn't he, we're now a working class party. I mean, what are the ideas that they're pushing and that distinguish them from previous forms of republicanism?
Well, to some extent, they are economic. And you see Biden trying to pull these voters away from them, too. So protectionism, which was long anathema in the Republican Party, at least since the Great Depression. The idea that corporations should not be immune from oversight. There are Republicans like Hawley and Ted Cruz who take a very jaundiced view of big tech companies. How much of it is just rhetorical is another question. If you talk to Democrats, they will tell you that the Republicans play at being a working class party, but they aren't actually looking out for their economic interests, because during the Trump presidency, you had massive tax cuts for the extremely wealthy. Nonetheless, the Republicans have long been able also to tap into cultural issues, the ideas of affirmative action, the idea that the Democratic Party is inimical to the white working class.
Affirmative action being policies that attempt to sort of almost set aside quotas for racial minorities in jobs and university places and so on.
Exactly.
But that's been around a long time.
It has, but I think the culture wars have intensified in the United States. If you want to talk about what Trump represents, it's obviously a form of American nationalism. And that nationalism, we can argue the degree to which it's centered on white ethnocentrism.
Yeah.
But there's clearly a strong element in there.
And of course, the fears of that base are being stoked because you're having a simultaneous radicalization on the left, most visible in Black Lives Matter. So just as the Trump supporters are saying things are already bad enough, they feel a renewed push from Black Lives Matter, et cetera, for what they regard as racial justice. So there'd be more of a clash, really.
Right. And then we can't forget the immigration issue, which was central to Trump's rise. The idea that these illegal immigrants are swarming over the border from Central and South America, and they want to take your jobs. And they're going to lower wages in the United States because corporations, of course, have long relied on these waves of immigration. And Trump managed to exploit the immigration issue extremely effectively. Now, this is, of course, no mystery to you. You had, I think, similar sentiments in the UK.
Indeed, in Britain right now, Boris Johnson is saying, we're not going to allow more immigration. We're going to raise wages for the working class. So there is a parallel there, I guess.
But there are a lot of these jobs, like in California, that are absolutely backbreaking and that is very difficult to find people who are willing to pick the fruits and vegetables in California.
Indeed, man the abattoirs in Britain.
Yeah.
So there is such a thing then as Trumpism, which has been built up around Trump. And do you see a process of pushback, though, within the Republican Party? I mean, in any coherent way, obviously you had Liz Cheney, who's regarded from a very conservative pedigree of her father being Dick Cheney, but didn't seem like many Republicans were following her.
No, they're either jumping on board or cowering. Liz Cheney is, to all intents and purposes, a neoconservative. And this very small but highly visible faction of the party, which included people like Robert Kagan, William Kristol, Max Boot, Jennifer Rubin, all of these people. Jennifer Rubin and Boot are both prominent columnists for the Washington Post. Kagan is also actually writing long essays for the Washington Post and has written a number of books. These were all people who previously used to champion figures such as John McCain. They were wedded to the idea of American greatness abroad, that by spreading the American creed, whether it was in the Middle East or in Asia, we are serving the highest American values. We're being true to ourselves. Now, both political parties have essentially dispensed with that, perhaps the Republicans even to a higher degree. But Liz Cheney, she has embarked upon a very fraught course. If she manages to win re-election, that would be something of a bombshell. And it's possible. There are a few Republicans that are willing to stick their head above the parapet, but not very many.
So turning then to the Democrats, obviously the sort of people who fear the Weimar scenario, that this is an interregnum and so on, are very concerned that Biden might fail and therefore open the door to a resurgence of Trump, and I think have been very concerned to see his recent drop in the polls. What is driving that sense that Biden is now less popular, maybe in trouble?
Until the Afghan venture went south in terms of the departure rather than the actual decision to leave. The decision to leave was popular. The execution was obviously very messy. Until then, the Republicans were unable to lay a glove on Joe Biden. They continually attempted to portray him as mentally decrepit, but they were getting zero traction. So he was seen as something of a Teflon president. Then came Afghanistan, where they could argue that his decision-making prowess was genuinely impaired. And add to that, the icing on the cake has been the conniptions inside the Democratic Party on Capitol Hill over getting the two infrastructure bills passed, one of which, the first was passed as bipartisan, the second one is his social agenda. Now these diverse wings, because the Democratic Party is more capacious than the Republicans, you have this bickering and this warring going on among the Democrats. They're going to have to settle on some kind of compromise in the next 3 weeks. Otherwise, the Biden presidency likely would be torpedoed. I think Biden is lucky that his numbers have sunk now rather than later. And he's fortunate, and maybe this was a conscious decision, to get Afghanistan out of the way, because it was never going to end well, no matter how much they planned that exit.
So, I mean, you seem to me to have quite a high opinion of Biden's political skills and his capacities as president. Why do you think maybe he's being underrated?
During the primaries, when Biden's being written off, I prognosticated in The Spectator that he would roar back to victory, and he did. He is a seasoned political operator. No, he does not possess the kind of mental or intellectual acuity that Barack Obama reveled in displaying. But Biden has sound political instincts. He was a senator for decades. He is trying to channel the common man. If you look at his speeches, everything that he does and says is aimed at middle America, including the pullout from Afghanistan, where he's saying, I'm not going to sacrifice one more life of your son or daughter for a senseless war, which was, in fact, a popular stand. The news cycle and the elites in Washington get very driven by day to day. And my read on Biden is that he actually has a pretty crafty plan for the next couple of years. He does have a vision for his presidency. I'm not trying to say that Joe Biden's going to go down in history as one of the greatest American presidents. I just have this strong sense that competence is what he wants to sell, and that's why he got into trouble in Afghanistan. But if he can get these infrastructure bills through, he is mastering the COVID crisis. The numbers are going down. When he declared that we were going to have national mandates, what were the headlines in all the newspapers and all the columnists? Oh, this will never work. It will backfire. It will make things worse. Baloney. The numbers show that Americans are acceding to the vaccinations.
National mandates being?
Requiring vaccinations for federal workers, for example, and in the Army. And now they're pushing them in New York for school teachers. These mandates historically have been necessary. There's nothing unique about them. They're portrayed by the Republicans as some grave invasion of personal freedom, which they're not. So Biden will be judged above all on the COVID crisis. It will never be completely gone, but he needs to end it as a crisis, and he needs to get his legislative program through. In the following year, next year, will all be about campaigns. I don't anticipate that he will have serious legislation going through next year.
So let's turn to foreign policy, which obviously the magazine you edit, The National Interest, follows very closely as a big sort of forum for debate on that. I guess for a lot of American allies, there's this background concern, the French being most vociferous in the wake of AUKUS and so on, that there's a continuity between Biden and Trump. And that continuity is America turning inwards, less prepared to play the role of global policeman and so on. Is that a valid concern or valid reading of where America is?
It is. And it was inevitable. The surprising thing after the Cold War is probably that America didn't retrench sooner. There was this burst of enthusiasm after 9/11 for foreign expeditions. But let's face it, the country has soured on foreign wars. Bob Kagan has tried to argue that America is an interventionist nation at heart. But I think the record, even in the 20th century, shows that the default is to revert, maybe we shouldn't call it isolationism, but to a more restrained foreign policy. At the same time, I don't believe that American credibility abroad has been severely damaged by the Afghanistan pullout. I think Biden wants to focus on domestic policy, but he cannot afford what is perceived as another foreign policy debacle abroad. He cannot afford to let the Baltic states come under Russian suzerainty. There's no way. He cannot afford to allow Taiwan to be grabbed by China. He would be pilloried by the Republicans. And I think that would be another death blow to his presidency. But Biden's proclivities are clear. He is an Atlanticist, but he clearly does not seem to think that Europe merits the kind of attention that China does. The consensus in D.C., interestingly enough, there he's very much conventional wisdom.
Yeah, I think it's very striking being here, the focus on China and the extent to which there is a bipartisan feeling that this is now the big threat that the United States is facing. Do you think that the people around Biden have a very traditional view of American power? They are quite wedded to America as number one and quite intent on maintaining that position, even if both the domestic and the international basis for that are weaker than they would have been in the past.
Definitely. I mean, you look at the key advisors, Bill Burns at the CIA, Tony Blinken at the State Department, and Jake Sullivan, head of National Security Council. All of them are very much foreign policy establishment figures. In the end, however, Biden does make the call. The recommendation to Biden was not to leave Afghanistan. He overruled it and went for it. The key question, it seems to me, and I don't know where you fall on this, is are we in fact inflating the China threat? Because where is it written that China is an ideological power that is trying to play the same role that the Soviet Union did during the Cold War? I'm not as convinced. I also wonder if, as with the Soviet Union, we underestimate the internal difficulties that China faces, aging population. Now we see the real estate bubble. It's by no means clear to me that it's fated for China to become this colossal superpower that seeks to dominate the world.
Yes, well, I think I've moved to a more hawkish position on China, definitely, in the last year or so, a couple of years. But I don't think I could give you definitive answers to either of those questions. I mean, I think another question, though, is, let's say that Biden and his advisors, at least on this issue, are as one, that China is the threat, that it has to be combated. A lot of what we've been talking about is, how do they carry the American people with that? Do you think the American people, in the end, would be willing to make whatever sacrifices might be required to have a second Cold War with China? Is there public backing for that?
At the moment, There isn't. You would need some kind of a crisis to animate the population. I mean, the Truman Doctrine required the Soviet takeover, not only of Eastern Europe, but then Greece specifically was what prompted Truman finally, I think, to enunciate what became known as the Truman Doctrine. And I don't see a galvanizing issue with China right now. Now, there are many people in Washington who would welcome some such challenge as a way to reunite America. One theory is that, to use a fancy phrase, America is succumbing to its fissiparous tendencies, or in plain English, falling apart, because we don't have the foreign enemy to unite us. And so instead, we resort to targeting each other, and these long-standing, latent animosities are coming to the fore.
That, I guess, is not entirely reassuring, since it suggests America needs an external enemy. Do you buy it? I mean, you posit it as a theory.
No, I think what America is going through is a convulsion. You have a country that is becoming multicultural, and it certainly is possible that what we call Hispanics may identify as white as well. There are all sorts of theories about why Republicans could, in fact, do better in the future. But the fact is, right now, is there a perception in America that the economic bounty that existed before is not there anymore? So you have the shrinking white majority worried that it's going to lose its share of the pie because other ethnic minorities are going to claim more. And it's the Democrats who are representing them. So this is a political and economic impasse that has not resolved itself yet. But one way or the other, it will. And I think Biden is trying to reconstitute this older notion of America as a melting pot and as a society in which the government does reassure working class white Americans that it's on their side, that it hasn't abandoned them. And that was Trump's message. And Biden's whole presidency is to try and steal back enough of those voters for the Democratic Party to exist as a powerful governing force.
That was Jacob Halbrun in Washington, ending this edition of the Rachman Review. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you'll be able to join me again next week.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.